Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of the Midwestern Social Scientists. This is officially episode 52. My name is Keith McIntosh, and I'm here with my esteemed colleague, friend, longtime friend,
Dr. Kit Pietrantonio. Episode 52, like every playing card in the deck. 52, down.
Folks, you can visit us at www.patreon.com/Midwestern. I want to remind you of that. We greatly appreciate any support, financial support. Kip and I do the show out of our own goodwill. Why do we do the show, Kip?
Mainly, I mean, I just really like the sound of your voice.
Is it? I thought you were going to say dedication to truth.
Yeah, no, not dedication to truth. It's mainly like the sultry, seductive tone of your voice that it helps me go to sleep at night. Like I put on my pajamas.
Really?
And I actually have a nightcap, like, you know, Ebenezer Scrooge style. And I, you know, I have little sheets and I get under and I listen to Keith and I go,
Can I make money off of this somehow? Should I start a kind of like, maybe I could just count sheep and record it.
Well, aren't those like,
what do you think?
What are those called? Like ASMR videos where they just like make, they like make little noises. They're like, hey, how you doing? And then they touch things. They'll be like,
that would be the life, wouldn't it? If you could just make a living off of your boring, deeper voice.
Yeah.
No, I think we do this because we're both social scientists. Right now I'm pursuing a PhD in sociology. I have two master's degrees in sociology. Oh. Why the hell I have two? Don't ask me. Bad life choices. Kip had more of a straight shot into a bona fide career.
You have like four degrees, don't you? Technically.
Yeah, making no money. Got a stack of degrees with no paper, no stacks of papers, just stacks of diplomas. And Kip is a psychologist and talks to interesting undergraduates for a living. And I think we're both sort of fascinated by pop culture, politics, religion, whole you know, slew of interesting things. And by nature, have always had a kind of I would say sociological, but kind of social scientific take on stuff. Uh-huh. And so we thought we might as well document it.
Yeah.
And keeping with that theme, well, we're both well versed in grad life, grad school life, the trials and tribulations of grad school life and being academics, for me, kind of an academic in training. And we thought we could have a discussion today about the seedy, dark underbelly of the academy.
That's right. And, you know, the intention today is not to be like, academia sucks or it's stupid or it's terrible. But there's tons of things that you would never know unless you've actually gone through the process of doing research, trying to publish it, getting it through the peer review process, and then being on the other side of that, like, you know, editing a journal, being a person who actually peer reviews, like a document that somebody sends to you. So when you hear like the term a peer-reviewed journal or like a peer-reviewed paper, what that literally means is a research paper gets submitted to other experts in the field. They decide whether or not it is publishable, if it should go in the journal. And they make that decision based on a whole bunch of stuff. And then if they approve it, everybody gives it the thumbs up, then it goes on to, you know, it goes into the journal and it becomes like official research. So, you know, the average American probably gets exposure to this type of research through like the news or like the morning radio or something. They'll say, you know, a new study has shown, you know, that, mm-hmm. you know, that apples mm-hmm. prevent heart disease or something like that. And you hope that that's legitimate, not just something that came from like a, you know, Newsweek or something like that, that it actually went through the peer mm-hmm. journal process. But I mean, that sounds really beautiful and scientific, but there's like all these little seedy underbellings and icky things that kind of like happen that I would say detract from the scientific process.
Mm-hmm.
That you,
when did you become so jaded?
Jaded. Oh my gosh. Around like, I'd say about year three of grad school.
what was your impression as an undergraduate walking the stacks in the library, mm-hmm. looking at all those official journals?
Well, I think the first thing is for me is I always just thought like, wow, everybody in here is like a genius. And mm-hmm. everybody who wrote these books or these journals or documents was clearly like an absolute expert who has read everything and knows everything about a subject matter, mm-hmm. which is not even close to the truth. And often is there's a problem with that, because as anybody, if you just pick up a random book and read it by an expert, you think that that's the truth, mm-hmm. as opposed to their perspective on a truth. So.
Yeah. I mean, I think I felt like there was just this incredibly impressive canon of knowledge, and it was impenetrable. It was as sound as anything else. And I had just some weird impression that, like you were saying, the folks who came up with that were just these geniuses, mm-hmm. like these crazy, ridiculous people on some, you know, high pillar that I could never reach.
Right.
And I think going to grad school and actually interacting with folks who are publishing frequently, or indeed publishing something yourself, and knowing how how many different directions your own paper could have gone, you appreciate how totally, you know, constructed journal articles can be. And I guess it just takes away, it doesn't feel sturdy as a rock anymore. It feels like it's sort of just what, you know, not that it's made up. It's unveiling something that's real, but what exactly it's unveiling is far less certain, at least in the social sciences.
Yeah.
Would you agree with that?
I would totally agree with that. And the piece about like what is actually being unveiled is really, really important, because there's so many little variables that go into making a research study legitimate and important and closer to truth, that if you just read something really quickly, you would never know, or if you've never done the research yourself. So there's this apprenticeship knowledge or something that you have to have. It's like you could read about like making a car or something, or repairing cars, like, and be like, oh, I know how to do this. But until you've just like worked as a mechanic for 10 years, you don't have the real feel for it. And I would say the same thing is like true for academics, that you could read a paper, but until you've actually like been in the lab or been in the, been like working on SPSS or working on, you know, in the statistics, you don't really know some of the problems. So, okay. But Keith, let's talk about one problem first. This is a good one, I think, to start with, and I would love to hear your opinions on it. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about samples. Like when we sample people, like what are your thoughts around that? Because I read a lot of studies that don't have the best samples. And so I'm curious what if you could maybe elaborate on some of the issues or problems related to that.
Yeah, I mean, when you say that, I'm reminded of grad students I know who are doing projects on a small scale, and due to modest resources are forced to have a small sample. And so they might talk to 10 people or 20 people, and they're creating a pilot study, in fairness, not to shit all over it, which I'll do in a second, and they build up, and I'm guilty of this too. I mean, it's just an issue of resources. They build up a whole theoretical argument based off of a series of, series of interviews, maybe one or two per person. And like I said, maybe 10 or 20 people. And it's very obvious that there's no way they can assert whatever it is that they're asserting. It might well be interesting. It might be kind of a theoretical development in the field. And it could well be, if they spoke to, 150 people, they'd find the same thing. And that would be much more convincing. Now, the purpose of that kind of sample isn't to make great generalizations about the whole world or the country or whatever it happens to be. But people tend to drag it in that direction almost instinctively, because, I mean, after all, you're trying to figure out something about the greater social world and not just 10 or 20 people. Mm-hmm. But I think that's a big issue, in that because sociologists are normal people, not very normal, but normal people in the general sense, and aren't working for giant corporations, they're forced to rely on relatively small sample. Even if it's quantitative and they have a few hundred, that's still modest in comparison to 3 million. I mean, if you work for Facebook and you're able to tap into some stream of millions and millions of users, that's such a different kind of social science than talking to a small handful of people. So I think for me, the big issue is not really being able to assert whatever it is you want to assert based off of talking to a handful of people. Mm-hmm. But this is coming from sociology. So how about you? What do you think? What are the big issues with sampling?
So I agree with you totally that just the pure, what we call the N, like the number of people that we sample in like a study, is often really small and inconsequential. You know, if you sample like 40 people, it pretty much doesn't matter what you're doing. That's not going to be enough people to like pull any truth from. And the other thing is I see a lot of studies like this. You'll read a study that says something like college students are becoming more liberal and like more lazy or something like that, right? Yeah. And what if you actually read the study, it'll be like a sample at a Midwestern university of yep. like 100 students found that these students didn't believe in hard work and were more likely to endorse political attitudes, like leftist political attitudes. But see, what people can't read between the lines in that is that they might have taken the sample from 100 students who are all in a sociology 200 class, right? Mm-hmm. Who are currently reading Marx, right? And the idea is like, well, that's why I have access to. And then by saying you can't identify like which university it is because you don't want to bias people. So you just say like a Midwestern university or an East Coast university. Mm-hmm. And so what ends up happening is you're making these sweeping generalizations about all college students based on 100 students who are in the class you're teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And that just seems like crazy to me. And so much research. I mean, almost every person who's ever taken a psychology class had to go do like a psychology experiment or had to go do like fill out a research study at one point.
Mm-hmm.
And that the fact that I just think college students do not represent even close to the norms of society. And if mm-hmm. you surveyed those college students during like when they're 18 during their freshman year versus their junior year, mm-hmm. they're like different people.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then another piece of that too, Keith, that I think is hilarious, and you've probably done this too. If you've ever cleaned up data, which is like a term that we mm-hmm. talk about, which it means like you go through the data and you like take out what we call outliers, which are like people who are like on the extremes, or you take out like, oh, they didn't fill out the whole survey. But like, I don't know about you, Keith, but like tons of times when I've given out survey studies, it'll be like, 3333333333 like the whole thing, like the person just keeps circling like the same or uh-huh. like there's no deviation. And so we just like accept that that's like them. Oh, that's the middle of the road. But we don't accept it. Like they might have just been like, I got to get through this as quick as possible, so I'm just going to keep circling threes, or maybe I'm just randomly jumping through, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so
yeah, I mean, that's entirely possible, but you can of course just guess and throw that stuff out into the garbage even if you suspect that that's what's going on. Is there any real in psychology attempt to wrestle with the fact that college students don't represent all Americans? Like, or is it just the fact that since all psychologists are in the same boat together, no one wants to rock the boat and like bring up the fact that they ought to be sampling other people, other adults in all in society?
Yeah, I mean, there is, but it's a lot of, and this is another one of the dark side things that we're talking about. A lot of these professors are so... they're so driven to publish because they could lose mm-hmm. their job if they don't mm-hmm. publish, that they will choose research questions that are very purposeful and intentional, that the college student sample is ideal.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So they'll just, rather than being like, oh, I want to do, like, I study social class, so I might want to do a research study on, like, blue-collar working-class people in rural America. But if you're a good social scientist, the first thought that should go to your head is like, oh, my God, how are you ever going to sample people like that?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because they don't have internet access. They don't necessarily, like, are all gathered in one place at one time. Mm-hmm. You know, versus, like, college students, it's like, well, we'll just do a college study because it's right here. I can get it published. You know, so it's simple. I don't know, Keith, what would you say? Would you say it's any different in sociology?
It depends. I think some sociologists have they can rely on data sets that are collected by other organizations. So there's the GSS, the General Social Survey, which is giant, Pew Research. There's organizations that are kind of dedicated, or the U.S. Census, organizations that are dedicated to collecting information on huge amounts of people. And that's a huge benefit, I think, mm-hmm. If you happen to be a quantitative researcher. if you're qualitative, which I am, I guess it's a more of a mixed bag. I think it's easier, I would say, all in all, for sociologists to access different populations. And there's a kind of, I don't know, authenticity where I think sociologists want to feel like they're willing to go into maybe dangerous situations, or at least like spend time, get outside of the academy and get to know maybe some neighborhood where poverty levels are high, and sort of ensconce themselves there for a year, write an ethnography, get to know people. I mean, I think there is an attempt for sociologists to kind of get outside of their bubble in some ways. In other contexts, you'll catch me complaining that everybody's in their bubble in academia.
Can you tell the difference really quick, just to our audience, mm-hmm. what the difference between qualitative and quantitative research is?
Yeah, qualitative deals with words and quantitative deals with numbers, like quantities. So if you're a qualitative sociologist, probably that means you sit down with people at a table and you have a conversation about their life and you record it and you turn that recording into text and you amass a stack of transcripts and then you use that as data to begin to analyze. So you might discover that after talking to hundreds of people, 85% of them said the same thing spontaneously. So that's a pretty good indication that there's something going on there. If you're a quantitative sociologist, you're probably an amateur statistician, and you're going to be sitting at a computer with some statistical package and a data set full of tens of thousands of people, probably, or more. And you're looking for connections, relationships between variables. Mm-hmm. That's in some ways way more powerful. Mm-hmm. And it tends to, quantitative research is published, I think, more easily because it feels more scientific. In some ways, it is more scientific. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, your hands are kind of tied behind your back because you are limited necessarily by the data set. Mm-hmm. Whereas a qualitative researcher is right there in the flesh with another human being and can ask very detailed questions and really get a rich, nuanced understanding of whatever's going on. Mm-hmm. So there's strengths and weaknesses to both.
Mm-hmm. And you cannot necessarily generalize qualitative research is kind of like the flip side. So when Keith said the word, like, it's more powerful, what he kind of means by that, or like my understanding of it, is that it doesn't represent like necessarily the whole societal norms, unless you have like a really big sample size or you have a really big quantitative sample, I guess is the best way.
Yeah,
versus a qualitative study is going to focus in on like getting a deep, it's like digging in deep into a subject matter.
That's exactly right. And I like qualitative research because I think I was interested in philosophy actually before I went into sociology. I just wanted to talk about life, and I wanted to do it in a way that was kind of connected to facts, as opposed to philosophy seemed to me far too abstract and esoteric. Like, I didn't really grasp like what the hell are these people talking about. It just seemed like building up ideas out of nothing. And maybe I was too critical of that, but I wanted to have a fact like, okay, well, here's, you know, we can say unquestionably that this demographic, a racial group, or people who make under 30 grand in real dollars are worse off now than they were 4 years ago. And because that's a fact, we have something to really sink our teeth into and have a more meaningful discussion. That's why I like sociology, but I really like just having a conversation about life, and that I think lends itself more to the qualitative side, whereas the quantitative is a bit more, I don't know, even when I meet sociologists who are quantitative, they're kind of a bit nerdier by nature and more into the facts and figures, mm-hmm. which is great, but it just isn't quite my sensibility.
Right. So, and that brings me to another like dark side, though, is that a lot of times in research, people will steal qualitative results to make really big statements in a quantitative paper. So, for example, let's say that your study was on the experience of racism of people, like people in the metro Atlanta area, right? And so you'll have people, they're like, oh, we did an interview with 15 African-American men who are from metro Atlanta, and we asked them about experiences of racism in Atlanta specifically. So the goal Keith is talking about is you get this very rich, deep understanding of the experience of racism in that particular city with the, like, in this neighborhood or that area, and you'd be able to get at things that you wouldn't be able to get to just by asking them, like, rate how much racism you've experienced in the last year on the scale, right? So, but the problem is a lot of times, Keith, I'll read papers that cite, meaning they reference one of the other papers as evidence, and they'll say, like, oh, you know, African Americans have, it has been shown that African Americans experience this, even though it was not, it's not just African Americans experience, it's these 12 men in Atlanta in this particular situation have experienced this, but they choose not to acknowledge those, like, details. So they're using the qualitative data as quantitative data. And a lot of times people do that because there's a lack of quantitative data.
Yeah, or it's like I would call it epistemological sloppiness. Ooh. People aren't really building. You like that?
I do like that. Ooh.
It turned out well, yeah. People aren't building. That has to do with how you build knowledge. And you have to pay attention to make sure the concepts you're using are coherent and logical and you're building properly. You're not sort of mixing, you know, like water and oil don't mix. And there's a tendency to want to try to do that sometimes. You have to be careful about that. What about, I was thinking about just the impression that I had that social scientists are a force for good in the world and trying to diagnose the way a doctor would the ills of society and provide solutions to otherwise intractable problems. How do we cure poverty? How do we stop racism? And then the realization, at least this one that I've had, maybe you've had a different experience, that, oh yeah, these are tired people who are, I'm talking about college professors who are, you know, overworked and underpaid and are also, and have dedicated a lot of their lives to their professional ambitions. And now are also trying to, like, spend time with their families. Maybe they've achieved tenure now and they're more interested in, you know, raising their kids, which is very understandable. And they fall into, and they're teaching. And so they fall into a place where their motivation becomes publishing, and they justify it understandably by saying, hey, I'm getting paid to publish, so I'm publishing. And this is an interesting topic and I want to shed more light on it. And yet they're not really doing anything to, say, change the world, which is sort of why they started, or at least ostensibly why they went into this field. And so I think there's a kind of jadedness that grad students start to feel when it's like, oh, they're idealistic undergraduates, and so they want to pursue sociology if it inspired them. And then they get in deeper, and then it's like, oh, wait a minute, we're just kind of like working in an office all day long. And is any of this stuff actually being read by anybody? Does this really matter at all? Like, what's really going on here? And I think that's a kind of a wake up call to a lot of grad students. And I think it's fairly dark.
Well, let's talk. That's awesome, Keith. And I totally agree with you that you have this beautiful idea. Or how about this one, Keith? You have this idea that you're going to be sitting in a lab and then you're just going to have this, like, breakthrough. Like, oh my gosh, it turns out depression is, you know, actually caused by traffic or something, and you're gonna, oh my god, we tell the press, like, we've solved depression, like,
it's gone, it's cured,
we've cured it, like, we figured it out, you know. It's like, that is not, that's never how it happens, ever. It will never happen like that, and you'll never have, like, that realization moment about anything, you know. So, and then the other piece you said about, like, people not reading it, like, you have to have an understanding of how these research articles and journals come out. So first thing is, there is just an industry out there that makes a ton of money off universities by being journals. And so every university wants to be like, oh, we have the most access to all these research materials. And so they pay these companies like JSTOR and, you know, and the APA or the ASA, all this money for their journals. But the truth is, like, nobody ever, like, Keith, I'm in this business and so are you. It's very rare that you, like, go into one of these journals, find an article, read the whole thing from beginning to end, spend time thinking about it. You know, like, what is more likely to happen is, like, I'm looking for a fact that I need to, like, make my argument, because I've already, like, know what I want to say. So I have to go back and, like, find an article, and I'm, like, skimming the results or skimming the discussion to find something that that's useful. And mm-hmm. what tends to happen is the papers that are like the easiest to get that information from get cited the most, and then they move up the search criteria ladder. And so even though like some study might be like some, let's say Keith McIntosh produces this amazing study that has these awesome results, it might never get as much like traction as some other really famous sociologist paper just because it has that sociologist's name in it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So Keith's paper goes completely unread and just sits there for years and years and years, and maybe someday somebody cites it. But there's almost like a, well, that person's smart, that person's smart. And a lot of times the papers get cited because people are friends.
Mm-hmm. Or yeah, absolutely.
Right? So like, oh, I'm going to cite this person because I know them and like I want to make sure their paper is in here. And so the process of what the cream rising to the top is not always like the best, or it's not always the breakthrough stuff.
It reminds me of The Economy, where you hear these facts about like the richest 88 people in the world have as much money as the bottom like 2 billion or something like that.
Right.
There's just this extreme exponential relationship when it comes in certain areas of life. And I think that's the case in academia, where you have the masses of people. I mean, there's so many universities in America alone, let alone the whole world. So many people publishing that there's no, if I'm citing random people out there in the world, my, say, supervisor is, he'll have no idea who those individuals are. And he wants to know that I'm, say, citing quality material. So it's kind of necessary that I write a paper where I cite famous sociologists, mm-hmm. because he'll be aware of them and he'll say, okay, yeah, I appreciate it. I know what they've written. And there's a kind of structural constraint there where you kind of, you have to be limited to some degree in who you cite, because you need to communicate to your superiors or to people who are reading your writing that you are in command of what's going on in the field. Mm-hmm. So there's only so much room for, like, you know, kind of rock star academics. There has to be just kind of a few big names out there, and you tend to go to those big names and include them in some of your research. And that's just kind of the way it is. You know, there's no obvious way around that. Mm-hmm. And then you might find some obscure article that speaks exactly to what you're doing that maybe wasn't cited by anybody. There's another part of it too I think is really interesting. And I'm not 100% on this, so correct me if I'm wrong about this, Kit, but mm-hmm. something like 80% of journal articles in the humanities receive zero citations. Mm-hmm. So in theory, we humanity academics are producing information to share so that people read it, improve their understanding of the world, and then usurp it and create more research. Most of it, though, nobody reads. Mm-hmm. And here's the thing. If I published a novel and nobody read it, my career would be over, mm-hmm. you know, or if 80% of the novels some publishing company produced, nobody bought, mm-hmm. that company would go under. But why doesn't the Academy go under? Well, because it's not a traditional business. I mean, there are, universities are in the position where they are forced basically to buy journals mm-hmm. that nobody's actually reading, to say this library is one of the best in the world because we have access to all the journals in existence. Mm-hmm. And at least some of that money is coming from the government. So in effect, it's a little dark because uh-huh. it's like your taxpayer money is going to, it's a bit of a racket in some ways. Taxpayer money in some ways is going towards something that's not obviously helpful. Right. You know what I mean? I'm an academic. I hate to shit on this too much, uh-huh. but there's something there that is a bit disturbing that I dislike.
I totally agree with you. Yeah, I mean, I think that is exactly how it is. And the fact that people, I mean, I've published papers that have never been cited or never, like, I assume nobody's read them, or, you know what I mean? It's very strange. But then, like, for example, I've written a book chapter, which is in a more famous psychologist book. And I've actually had people come up to me and be like, oh, I read your book chapter.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and that's like, it's like, well, the only reason you read it is because it's like in this other book that is like more famous than me by far.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
There's something weirdly capitalistic. It kind of also reminds me of like YouTube or something, you know, like people posting these videos, they get like 3 views,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it's just, they go nowhere, and it's kind of like they're trying to get famous, or they're trying, I don't know. It's really, really interesting. Wow. Yeah. The other part of it too, Keith, which is really strange or weird or whatever, is how people... Okay, so what you tend to think of when you think of the scientific method is that people construct a theory, they have a hypothesis, a question, and then mm-hmm. what they do is they, like, try it out, and it either works or it doesn't work. But one of the seedy underbelly pieces is that only papers that have, like, remarkable results get published. And you're supposed to repeat, like, a big part of science is, like, it should be replicable, meaning that you should do the study again and again and again, and if you get the same results over and over again, then it's, like, truth, right? Mm-hmm. But nobody ever, Keith, have you ever even heard of somebody doing a replication study?
No, not in sociology. Usually it's, the closest to that is somebody 10 years later kind of following up on something.
Mm-hmm. But, like, what should be actually happening is you should be exactly copying somebody else's results and seeing if you get the same thing with different people, mm-hmm. right? But, like, nobody ever does that,
mm-hmm.
right? And so then something is remarkable and it comes out, it may not be truth because they may have made a mistake or there may have been something weird going on. Like, in the psychology class that they did it in, all the students might be really upset because the football team lost that week.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and like, oh, all of a sudden these students are more depressed or whatever, uh-huh. you know, it could mm-hmm. be a million things. The weather, it could have been raining that day. You know, the professor could have just given back the results to a quiz and the grades were bad. So the students were like angry when they filled out the survey.
Do you think in some way that like the university itself has almost run its course and that it's in need of like severe restructuring? Like it, you yeah. know what I mean? Because I was reading that in like, I forget now, something like 1810, like. I'm making this up a bit, but it's like something like 7% of Americans went to high school, graduated high school. Mm-hmm. And by like, you know, the end of the 1800s, like a small fraction went to college. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a weird thing though. There's so many people going to college now. Like it's such a major event in life. So this institution that started off for different reasons has kind of mutated mm-hmm. and it's kind of a factory now, you know, it's just kind of kicking out students and also grad students and, you know, would-be professors. I wonder if it's kind of collapsing under its own weight or something like that.
I think it is. And I think, Keith, the other thing is the products that it produces in terms of research are antiquated.
Mm.
You know, and it's not going to evolve because there's so much investment in the process as it is. So when I make a paper, I have to do like a lit review. I have to outline these methods. I have to outline the results. And I have to do this all in a black and white, old-fashioned document.
Mm-hmm.
That is like looks antiquated, even like the way the APA, which is the American Psychological Association, has like the graphs set up on the documents is like super old fashioned looking. I mean, it was the same in the 1970s as it is now, you know?
Yeah.
And
wow.
When you think about the fact that like how much technology we have, or like when you open up like a research paper, wouldn't it be way cooler if it was like there was a video that popped up of the researcher? And they were like, oh, hey, how are you? Like, this is what I've did for research. This is study. And then they had like a little thing that was like, these are the results. And what's interesting mm-hmm. is like, pay attention to this.
Mm-hmm.
Like a video.
Even if the abstract would just came in the form of a 2-minute video.
Mm-hmm. But we don't have that. And so it ends up being like kind of silly or like nobody's willing to do that. And just by adding that little bit of flair or making it more congruent with people's lives, people would actually read the research or listen to the research. You know, so I actually think like if I were to publish papers from now on, it would be better. And Jordan Peterson actually talks about this. Like he can do research and then tell the 40 people in his class about the research. Or he can go on YouTube, talk about his research, and 1 million people will listen to it. So mm-hmm. why would he even tell the 40 people in his class,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah,
and I think
absolutely.
That's a huge problem. And I think if universities started producing cool stuff that was really applicable to people's lives, like people would like use it and they would look into it. So another example, yeah, and I guess another example of that is like how you actually search for the information. Like imagine if I was like you know, some guy, you know, working some factory job or something like that, and I needed to know something. Imagine if I could go to a university's website and learn about it really, really quickly, almost like Google.
Mm-hmm.
But instead I can't because you have to have so much knowledge just to understand like how a journal works mm-hmm. order to get like the, it's like there's this maze and the cheese is at the end of the maze. And it's like, mm-hmm. we don't even need the maze. Like, we can just give people the cheese, you mm-hmm. know, but we make everyone learn the maze in order to even like begin to see the cheese.
Yeah. 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 And I don't know how how good is the cheese these days?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I'm not even sure sometimes exactly how profound these insights are. I was going to say also, by the way, that's why TED Talks are so powerful. Like, mm-hmm. I really like finding, if an academic has given any kind of talk and it's on YouTube, I love that because you get a sense of their personality, which can be, I mean, you don't want to go for the ad hominem thing. Like, if somebody doesn't, seems, you know, whatever, weird, you dismiss what they're saying. You want to listen to what they're saying. But I think there's some value in the way people present themselves. And you can sort of tell, like, the way someone's mind works based on how they speak extemporaneously. So I love listening to a YouTube lecture and would prefer that to you know, an hour of that, I think, is preferable to an hour of reading, uh-huh. or at least as a kind of preface for the book. Like, I'll watch a lecture before reading the book so I have a better sense of what the author means. Yeah, I wonder if universities will become, as students go into debt and then are pissed off about being in debt for little reward, and also increasingly sense that there's no real wisdom being gained. I mean, I think that's why the humanities exist, not to give you wisdom, to give you judgment. Like, an engineer knows how to create like a widget. You know, they can get a job making a widget and make a good living. But ideally, the humanities it's like the big picture and thinking about like how everything fits together and having some wisdom. If people feel like they're not even getting that, which I think increasingly they feel like they're not, I wonder if it'll kind of break apart and folks will get some kind of accreditation through online universities, which maybe will rise in stature and become much more reputable. And you'll get a kind of division between really, really good lecturers who make really great videos and are just good teachers, and then maybe a few people who are good researchers who maybe aren't so great at lecturing, who will continue doing kind of the old-fashioned work at the academy, you know, in the ivory tower. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think the piece that I would add, I agree with you. I think that's probably what's, yeah, I don't know. Because I think of like charismatic professors and I think about how their reviews come up. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's like, mm-hmm. if you're a really good teacher, more students want to take your class, which means the department makes more money. Mm. Yeah, but on the other hand, you have to produce the research in order to get tenure. So there's like this, a lot of professors are stuck in this role where they're kind of like slaves to their students' reviews.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So then the student's like, oh, like I didn't like that I got a bad grade in this class. I'm going to rate you badly. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't realize like that actually has a huge impact on that person's life, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then, the research thing is like also out of your control.
I think being an academic is, you have two full-time jobs. Uh-huh. You really do. And it's like it's two different skill sets. I think being a good talker in real time in front of a group of judgmental, you know, adolescents is a different skill than being good at navigating stacks of books or online data sites and writing, you know, for journals. I think they're just two different skill sets and they require full-time work, really. Uh-huh. So I think what you get is a lot of people who are not creating great research because they have to teach 3 or 4 classes and grade, you know, papers from 18 and 19 year olds. And then people who aren't fantastic lecturers because they're also worried about writing and publishing. So it's like both jobs are done somewhat poorly. And I think that's just the fault of the structure of the academy. And it's too bad there's not a better way of restructuring that, you know?
Yeah, I think there's, well, I guess that people would argue that like teaching colleges are kind of the result of, or like R2 or R3, yeah. which the R system just means like how much research is getting produced at the school. So like an R2 or an R3 school isn't producing as much research, so they value teaching more, you know?
And I think generally those aren't as prestigious though, right?
They're not considered as prestigious and they tend to not be as big. Which is another big piece of it. So then they don't get as much funding and, you know, and all that kind of stuff from the government. But here's another piece, Keith, that I wanted to talk about, if that's okay, is I want to talk about, like, the peer review process a little bit more in mm-hmm. terms of, like, the nuts and bolts of actually reviewing something. So mm-hmm. this is something that I've done. And I'm doing it on like the editor side, but I've also done it on the journal, like the journal, being the peer reviewer side. So I've been like the editor role, or I'm in the process. I'm actually doing it now, and then I've been in the peer reviewer role. And one of the things that's like really, really interesting is when you get asked to be a peer reviewer. So how the process works is somebody submits somebody submits an article to a journal. The article then gets put up to the editor, who reads it initially. The editor then goes, okay, I know three people who should review this, who should look at this. And the idea is that you will get three people who are experts, but perhaps experts in different parts of the paper. So you might get somebody who's like an expert on the subject matter. So let's say we're doing a paper on obsessive compulsive disorder. So you'd want to get somebody who's like an expert on OCD. You'd want to get somebody who's an expert on the stats that the person ran. And then sometimes you want to get somebody who's kind of like on a different wavelength. So maybe you get a peer reviewer who like has a different take on OCD, or they believe OCD is like something else. It's just like an anxiety disorder. So they're an expert on anxiety, yeah. Right? So that's like the perfect setup, right? And then they read the paper and they give these excellent recommendations, and they tell the person how to fix it, or they say this paper needs more work, you should do this, and then send it back to them, and then the person reviews it again. Or, you know, ultimately they give recommendations and the paper gets published. Okay? So that's what's supposed to happen.
Sounds great.
Sounds great, right? That should be pretty good, right? So I think what people picture is like peer review is like this group of smart academics sitting around a table, like being like, let us read, like, this is our full-time job. We sit here all day and we decide what is science. It's like Neil deGrasse Tyson, right, is sitting there with like Richard Dawkins, you know, and Sam Harris, and all these geniuses are sitting around reading these papers, deciding what is scientific and what isn't. Mm-hmm. Here's the truth of what really happens is that usually if the editor is like, the editor's pretty desperate because they have like 10 or 12 articles that they have to get reviewed. Mm-hmm. So they start asking like experts first, but the experts are too busy. So they'll say like, you can decline it. You can be like, oh, I don't have time to review any papers. So no thanks. Mm-hmm. Right. And so then you end up asking more people, and you ask more people, and you ask more people, and pretty soon you almost become like kind of desperate, and you're like, can you please do this? Can you please do this? Like, oh, like, and there almost becomes like a reciprocity. Like, I did it for you, so you have to do it for me.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so it's almost like silly, you know, it's so you end up just getting people who are willing to do it. Then a lot of times people will just pick some, like the reviewers themselves don't have as much time as they probably should to like really research the article. And so what they end up doing is they just go like, read it really quickly. And they're like, I would kind of fix this. This is okay. And then kind of make a snap judgment on it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Or here's the even better part is sometimes they don't even understand parts of the paper. Because even though you're an expert in something, doesn't mean you're an expert in every single aspect of it, or that you've read every single thing that's ever been about it. So, like I said earlier, Keith, like my area of expertise is like social class. Well, do you think I've read every single paper in psychology on social class, or I'm aware of every field of study within
social class? It'd be impossible.
It's impossible. So if somebody's going down a line of thought that I just haven't explored yet, like, I can kind of know what they're talking about. I guess like the good thing for me to do would be go read all those papers. But realistically, who has the time to not just read their paper, but the 7 or 8 papers that they cited?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you have any thoughts on
that. Well, so it's like, well, I think it's just, I mean, it's no one's fault per se. It's just the way things turn out. But yeah, so you're in a situation where the reviewers aren't experts now, or they're experts in an area, but they're not experts on your paper precisely. And they don't have that much time. Uh-huh. And so they're not going to sit and you know, studiously go over with a fine tooth comb everything about your paper, which is really what ought to happen.
Uh-huh.
So instead, like you say, there's just a snap judgment that takes place, and then the paper gets kicked back to the writer, right?
Uh-huh.
And they need to then respond to changes. But some of those comments might not be that profound or insightful, In fact, some of the comments potentially could be more destructive than constructive if the person didn't really understand what it was that the paper was arguing for in the first place. Mm-hmm. And then that puts the writer in a dilemma, because it's like, well, do I kind of dumb down my paper to please the reviewer? Mm-hmm. Or is there some way of kind of communicating this? Or what do I do? And so, like, what, I don't know, how does that end up resolving itself? You have more experience with this than I do.
Well, I think the other thing you got to add in there, Keith, is everybody's being super hyper polite.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes you can't really, like, you're reading the comments, or you're reading, like, you're trying to figure out what the person's really saying. Like, for example, Keith, let's say that a reviewer, and this has happened to me, they give feedback that's clearly, like, dumb, or they mm-hmm. clearly didn't read the paper, or they didn't understand the paper. And it's mm-hmm. not the kind of thing where it's like, well, you don't understand how smart I am. Like, you missed my – it's literally like, we did that. You just didn't read it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's in mm-hmm. a different section. You just didn't pay yeah. attention to that, right? So you can't say to the person, like, hey, dummy, you didn't do that, because, like, you're afraid of them, because they yeah. have the power to publish your paper, and your career may be based on that, right?
Yeah.
So what you end up doing is you end up doing this really weird dance where you're like, thank you so much, like, sir or madam, for the feedback. It was absolutely helpful. You know, we have addressed this. We would also like you to look at this line, which may partially have addressed what some of your concerns were. We have mm-hmm. elaborated on that within this section.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much for the feedback. Yeah. It's incredibly helpful. You know, Dr. And here's Antonio. Right?
Yeah, and here's a bouquet of roses and a candy bar.
Right, exactly. And that's what happens. And you'll know there's almost like jokes about it. They say, like, you know, like, the second or third reviewer is always like this oddball character mm-hmm. who you kind of have to, like, deal with, you know. And then the other thing, Keith, is, like, people's biases and stuff come in. So let's say I'm a psychologist who's committed to a very specific theoretical orientation or lens, or so mm-hmm. let's say you're a sociologist, you're like, I hate Marx, or I'm a symbolic interactionist, you know, exclusively, mm-hmm. right? Like, if I'm reading the Marx paper or something like that, I might say to myself, like, oh, I don't believe anything Marx says, so I'm not going to publish this paper, because they've clearly not deconstructed Marx. Even yeah. though the paper isn't on Marx, it's on, like, some specific, like, part of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember, Keith, there's been times where I've read papers that were, like, on social class, where I have been like, oh, well, this paper's not that great, but there's also nothing else on this subject out there.
Mm-hmm.
So even though the paper's not that great, is it better to publish it because at least it fills a niche?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not even based, like, I you know, I am, but, like, because I don't just settle for that. I go into more depth analysis. But somebody else might just go, like, nope, I don't agree with this ideologically, so it's no good.
How about this? Do you ever find, when you're looking for, maybe you're creating a literature review mm-hmm. and you're digging into the research, and the smart thing to do, I think, is to go for journals that are reputable, because ideally the research is top notch.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're looking for something very particular, you look for that subject matter. And so you might find somebody somewhere mm-hmm. in the middle of the country wrote something relevant.
Mm-hmm.
And you look at the article and you read sometimes it's like not even a sentence. Certainly within a paragraph, you can tell this is really poorly written.
Mm-hmm.
And just, it doesn't feel, the language is dumb. It feels inappropriate. Mm-hmm. It's just not well constructed. And methodologically, it's not well constructed. And it's almost impossible to know whether whatever they're concluding is actually real or not.
Mm-hmm.
And I just end up, like, I feel embarrassed for the person. And I just sort of wonder how it's even possible for such poor research to get out there. Because
mm-hmm.
it really brings it home that it's a sham when it doesn't even feel smart to read. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Well, and yeah, just some journals just publish anything.
Yeah.
You know? And I've been asked by lower tier journals to review things, and I'll reject a paper, and they'll be like, are you sure? Like, are you sure you want to reject this? Like, could you just read it one more time or a few more times? And I'm like, yeah, I'm sure. These problems yeah. didn't change. Like, you know, because if there's fundamental things in the paper that are, like, if there's, like, not the big enough sample size, or they didn't ask the right questions, they can't just change how they wrote it to fix it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Does that affect, if you were to push something through, does that affect your career in any way? Or is it more just your integrity? You don't want to push something through that you know is not up to snuff.
I don't think it would affect your career in any way, because nobody would, there's no list of these are the people who reviewed these papers.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's an anonymous process, and that's very, I actually agree with that a lot, though. That's an important thing, because you don't want to get into the game where people are hoping to get a certain reviewer, or like they get mad at somebody for rejecting their paper. Mm-hmm. And sometimes people can even kind of, because you're also, the paper you're reviewing, you don't know who wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
And then vice versa, like, they don't know who's reviewing it. I think that objectivity is really, really important. But sometimes people can guess
mm-hmm.
who wrote a paper because they, like, recognize the style of writing, or they recognize the subject matter. Mm-hmm. And they're like, I think I know who wrote this paper. And I've seen that bias people, too.
So if the person's famous, you might want to push it through. And if you have some grudge against them, you might not.
Or if they're your friend, you might push it through.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I will add, though, that all these sort of problems are just because we're human beings, you know, and like in any kind of corporation or business, you have all this sort of the dirty underbelly, you know. It's really hard to make it any sort of operation like this that pristine.
Uh-huh.
And it probably is the case that overall academics are decent folks who are trying to, you know, create some. I mean, I just don't think that there's more dirt here than in other areas, probably less so.
One, and think when you compare what happens in academia, where there's actually like what we call an IRB, which is like an institutional review board, compared mm-hmm. to like what's going on in a pharmacy company
mm-hmm.
or what's going on in like some big corporation, like the type of research. Oh my gosh, it's got to be so much better and like less profit driven.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in a university compared to like how Pepsi does their research or Coke or cigarette companies, or you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like I almost think of the Keystone Pipe or the Dakota Access Pipeline, then being like, there will absolutely not be a spill. We've shown that it's perfect, you know, or whatever. And it's like, yeah. You know, within a year or whatever, there's a spill. You know, yeah. It's like, well, I wonder if that research that it was going to be fine and perfect was kind of biased, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we probably want to bring this one to an end soon, but we could maybe talk more. I think it'd be kind of cool to do another part of this and talk a little bit more about why we think research goes, I don't know, like there are these sort of fads. Like I was thinking about the language of like being triggered, or safe spaces, or like Peggy McIntosh, who shares my surname, mm-hmm. wrote the white privilege paper back in the 1980s.
Yeah, I've met her.
Oh, have you? Is she nice?
She was, yeah. I mean, she was like I don't know if she was nice or not. She mm-hmm. came and did a talk at UC Santa Cruz while I was there. Mm-hmm. And I met her and saw her, and I listened to her talk for like an hour, and there was only like 30 of us in the room. So it was pretty cool.
That's cool. Yeah, I've seen her TED talk. Mm-hmm. How some of these concepts would, like her paper, I think is interesting because it's called something like a personal white privilege.
I know it's called Unpacking the Knapsack.
What's the, is there another title?
Yeah,
like, is that
something,
a colon?
Something white privilege, but
I think it's like a personal account of white privilege, something yeah. like that. And the reason I bring that up is because it's not, you know, that's not exactly a robust, rigorous, piece of research. It's not a piece mm-hmm. of research. It's a personal account, you know. It's kind of like a thought piece.
All right,
which
I found the name, Keith.
What is
it? It's White Privilege: Unpacking the Invisible Knapsack.
Mm-hmm.
And it was yep. And so, just to give you an idea, it was written in 1989, and it has been cited by 3,578 other papers.
So this is one of those rock star papers that just flies off the charts. And so 80% get zero citations, but some get all of them. Uh-huh. And just how some of those ideas become tremendously powerful and shape research.
Uh-huh. So were you saying that it's not actually like a research paper? It's just, it's like a list of white privileges.
Yeah. And that doesn't mean that it's not super helpful or valuable or like provocative. It can do great good. But I don't think there'd be any way to argue that that's a piece of research.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no like method to it, you know. And it's not as if you're setting up anything quasi scientific.
Right. I think it was one of the first major times where somebody like opened up that idea of white privilege and gave really concrete examples that people could think about.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think probably Peggy McIntosh has a pretty good PR team. You know, like, I mean, she, you know, I think she made a living out of, like, going around and talking about that article in the same way that, like, Angela Davis does. You know, she's Angela Davis, another kind of, like, rock star academic who, like, doesn't really teach. I mean, I think she has, like, a position technically at a university, but her job, just like Neil deGrasse Tyson, right? He just kind of goes around and talks about science or talks, she talks about white privilege or somebody talks about racism and. You know, they're not in the lab, in the research. They're not reading academic articles all day long. They're, like, kind of invested in their persona or advancing the science in a different way.
Yeah. It is interesting because they become – they're treated as academics, like somebody like Peggy McIntosh. But, like, at least that idea is just a – it's a conversation, you know. It's just a way of describing the world. And I think sometimes that gets lost a bit. People aren't as sort of critical of that part of it, you know.
Right, yeah, that it's an idea. But the cool thing is a lot of times when people write those theoretical papers, they open up research questions that then people explore. So they're in, like, in psychology, and I'm sure in sociology, there's been, like, thousands of studies on white privilege now, you know, and, like, the effects of white privilege and how aware people are of their white privilege, and the more privileged people are, what is the effect on that, you know? And so it kind of opens up these research questions that people... And I guess that's, like, really good science at the end of the day, right? Like, somebody puts out a theory and then a bunch of people test it.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I guess that's the upside is, like, the more imaginative end of it, it's less scientific, but at least you're kind of probing new territory that can be explored later in maybe a more empirical fashion.
So there's a really – let me give a really cool, like, historical example, and then maybe we can end on this. Yeah. So a lot of people know the psychologist, like, B.F. Skinner. Right. So B.F. Skinner invented behavioralism. So if you've ever heard, like, classical conditioning or operant conditioning, which is, like, positive reinforcement and punishment and all that, that's B.F. Skinner. Well, B.F. Skinner came out with this paper about language. And so he was, like, the hot thing at the time. Like, he was, like, the Elvis Presley of, like, you know, everybody was Freud and psychoanalytics. And here comes B.F. Skinner with his, like, that's all BS. The truth is everything's, like, it's like math. And humans are like math, and if you add if you had something, a behavior increases, and if you subtract something and punish it, behavior decreases, and that's the way the world works, right? And people are like, yeah, screw Freud, Freud sucks, like, this is the truth. And it was, like, hyper-American, and, like, you know, it's like almost like turning people into, like, accounting ledgers, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
They literally would get it down to numbers, Keith. They would be like, if I reinforce something this many times, then it takes to a person. If I don't reinforce it this many times, it's not going to work, you know? And so they started, like, you know, businesses started incorporating this, everything else. So he then wrote it about language. And so B.F. Skinner was like, oh, language is really just you get reinforced for making little noises. So you start off by saying, like, duh, randomly. And then when you say duh, your mom is like, oh, you said duh. That's like dad. And then you as a baby are like, oh, that's wonderful. Oh my gosh, I liked how my mom responded. So I'm going to say duh again. And then eventually it turns into dad, you know, and you keep getting, and eventually dad comes out and you get reinforced. So, like, people are like, oh wow, B.F. Skinner, another home run, right? So this theory gets, like, established, right? Because he didn't, like, grab a bunch of babies and test this. He just, like, was like, oh, everything else works like this. This must work like this too. Enter Noam Chomsky. Right, who's like a straight up linguist, and he goes, wow, like, this is completely idiotic, and, like, it isn't how it works, and there's no truth to this, and, like, this guy's not a linguist, and he shouldn't be talking about this, and there's no evidence that this is how it is, and if this is true, like, how come all these other things don't happen? And he breaks down B.F. Skinner's article, like, thing line by line by line, like, saying, like, here's all the problems with it. And then, of course, people go on to test Chomsky's theory versus Skinner's theory. And they found that Chomsky was right, that babies are born with, like, innate language skills, that they're not, like, conditioned into babies. And so, like, literally, it was like some guy came out of a theoretical paper, somebody else came out of the counter, and it changed the course of psychology, like, forever. And I just think that's, like, so cool. You know, it's like both these theories were proposed, and then they tested them, and then, like, one won. Or one of the theories actually became victorious and became, like, the facts, you know?
Yeah, and I suppose that's the way it should be, right? I mean, that's how it ought to work.
So I just love that story, you know? And then B.F. Skinner had sour grapes about it, like, his whole career.
Did he really?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Like even into like the 80s and 90s, he died in like 91 or something like that. But in the 80s, he was still like, he never proved me wrong. He just got it wrong. Like he wrote responses and stuff, but nothing was ever as famous as like Noam Chomsky's paper.
That's beautiful. That's wonderful.
It's I don't know. I just love that. It's like a clear case of somebody winning in academia. And yeah. So, anyway, that's one of the reasons I love Noam Chomsky so much. So
nice. But, all right, Kip.
All right. So
wrapping it up.
Well, hey, you all out there in YouTube and podcast world, what do you think about all this stuff? Are there some other seedy underbellies to academia that we missed? Are there other facts about peer review? Were you surprised? We'd love to hear about them. Put them down in the comments below. Subscribe and like us and do all that good stuff too.
That's about it.
So I am Dr. Kip Pietrantonio.
Macintosh.
Peace out.
So.
Hey guys, if you enjoyed the show, check out Kip and Keith on Facebook at Midwestern Social Scientists. You can also tweet them at hashtag Midwestern Social Scientists. Or you can check out their Podomatic page, which is the first place the episodes get released. Don't miss out. Yeah, just check out their Facebook, okay? Thanks.